From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, new research shows that certain foods can be addictive and that food addiction is one of the lesser noted contributors to the obesity epidemic. We'll talk in the hour ahead to some leading researchers on the subject of food addiction and why there are comparisons being made to what you eat and such things as nicotine, morphine, and ethanol. Addictive foods and addictive eating and what you can do with your calls, emails, and online questions and comments after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. Obesity has long been blamed on overeating, genetics, lack of willpower, and lack of exercise, but increasingly another contributor to the epidemic is being seen as food addiction. And in this forum hour, we want to explore new research on food addiction and the causes behind some people's inability literally to stop eating. Joining us in studio is Rob Lustig. He's professor of pediatrics in the Division of Endocrinology, directs the Weight Assessment for Teen and City Health Program. It's called the WATCH Program at UCSF Medical Center, and welcome to the program again.
Thank you.
Glad to have you back here. Lisa Appel is also here in studio. She's a professor in UCSF's Department of Psychiatry, director of COAST, UCSF Center for Obesity Assessment, Study, and Treatment. Welcome. Good morning.
Thank you.
And Dr. Rana Kabatsnik, who is a PhD, is in studio with us as well, assistant clinical professor in the Department of Psychiatry at UCSF. It's all UCSF morning. Author of a book called The Zen of Eating, Ancient Answers to Modern Weight Problems, developed the META program, Mindful Eating Training Through Awareness, and she's a board member of the Center for Mindful Eating, and we welcome you.
Thank you.
Glad to have you all. And if I may, Rob Lustig, let me begin with you, and let's begin by talking about some of this new research. We're talking really about rats eating Oreo cookies and Fruit Loops and things like that, which they can't stop eating, I understand. We'll get into that. But we're talking about food addiction from kind of four different levels, so run it down for us.
Well, in order to be an addictive substance, the American Psychological Association states that you have to be able to satisfy four criteria. They are binging, withdrawal, craving, and cross-sensitization with other drugs of abuse. Now, the first three are obvious what they mean. The fourth one states that if you expose an animal, for instance, to one substance, then that means that they're going to have a heightened neurologic response to a second substance. For instance, if you expose a rat to nicotine, then they'll have a more heightened reaction to morphine. There are specific macronutrients. There are specific things in our diet that subserve all four of those criteria. The main one that people have been focusing on, and my particular interest, is sugar. Now, sugar,
especially
has,
high fructose.
Well, it doesn't really matter. Sucrose and high fructose corn syrup, it's a tempest in a teapot. They're the same. The Corn Refiners Association launched an entire campaign to demonstrate no metabolic differences between high fructose corn syrup and sucrose. I agree. They're both equally bad, they're both equally toxic, and they're both equally addicting. That's what they don't tell you about. So hopefully the viewers and listeners will understand that we're not talking specifically about high fructose corn syrup. This is a general phenomenon across the board for pretty much all sugar.
I only mentioned high fructose corn syrup because I think you called that or characterized that as alcohol without the buzz. You
know? Well, no, I said fructose in general.
Yeah.
And sucrose is half fructose. High fructose corn syrup is half fructose.
So we're really talking about sugar across the board.
Right. There's natural sugar and there's synthetic sugar, but sugar is sugar. Doesn't matter where it comes from. The part of sugar that makes it sweet is called fructose, and it's the problem.
Honey?
Honey as well. Agave, same thing. Maple syrup, doesn't matter where it comes from. Now, it just so happens that with agave, maple syrup, and honey, because they cost more and because they have a specific and distinctive flavor, people tend to use less of them in recipes. But if gram for gram, ounce for ounce, molecule for molecule, exactly the same.
And sugar means addiction, or can indeed mean addiction, in the traditional terms of what we define as addiction.
At least in laboratory animals. Now, The question is that true in humans as well? There's a huge amount of anecdotal data that supports this. There's a huge amount of epidemiologic data that supports this. Have we been able to actually demonstrate mechanistically that this is the case in humans? Not yet. We're working on it. It's one of the things we're doing.
Well, you're also working just in general with what drives us in the way of dopamines and biochemicals. I mean, to a great extent, seeing a lot of this biological groundwork being laid and telling us a lot that we need to know about why we eat and why we eat the things that we eat.
Right. Well, it's not just eating. I mean, the fact of the matter is dopamine is the reward neurotransmitter. There's an area of your brain called the nucleus accumbens, which receives the dopamine signal from a different part of the midbrain. And it's all about that signal. That's the signal that gets you up in the morning. That's the signal that makes it worth going to work in the morning. And the bottom line is, every one of us has our addictions. For rich people, it's money or power. For middle-class people, it's cocaine, ethanol, cannabis, nicotine. And for the dirt poor, unfortunately, it's sugar.
Well, if it is an addiction, I wonder, Rick Berman, who is head of the Center for Consumer Freedom, a somewhat conservative libertarian organization, says he doesn't see anybody holding up convenience stores for Twinkies. I mean, it's easy to be sort of disregarding and glib like that, but people normally don't think in the terms of, I have the sugar rush, I need to feed it, like I need to feed morphine or the comparison, in fact, is to ethanol in great extent.
Well, our data shows that fructose and ethanol basically do exactly the same thing in the liver and the same thing in the brain. So they're very, very similar. The reason no one's holding up convenience stores for Twinkies is because they're so cheap you don't have to.
Well, also, I think it's important to make the distinction between
this is Alyssa A. Paul.
Food is what we call a natural reward. So it leads to a subclinical stimulation of that reward center in the brain that responds to drugs of abuse. So drugs of abuse cause kind of super physiological stimulation. And what we're talking about here are two things. There's people with true food addiction, which is a small proportion of the population. But in this extreme case, it demonstrates that there is this tragic condition and disorder that highly palatable food can cause. But what we're really concerned about from a public health perspective is the effect that food has on the brain, because it can have an addictive quality. And that ability of food to stimulate the reward center may be underlying part of and driving part of the obesity epidemic. So not that people are addicts, but that we are eating food not based on a conscious decision, but no one wants to be obese, but people are eating more than they want because they don't feel they can control their eating behavior in
You're saying there's no free will? It's involuntary?
Well, you put rats in a cage with junk food. They overeat and they become obese. You surround people with a toxic food environment, and what do we see? We see over 65% of our population being overweight or obese against our will. It's not all about our volition. We've tried to blame individuals and talk about willpower, and that's just gotten us nowhere.
Well, let's talk about where we can go for a moment. Now, we want to talk about the research largely, but I know you study with Kelly Brownell, the Yale psychologist who is, as I saw in video, I thought, a little paunchy guy, gave us the word yo-yo diet, in fact, or gave us that whole concept of the yo-yo diet. But he's talking, for example, about sin taxes on things like sugar and policies of that sort, which, drives libertarians up a wall. Is that the sort of thing that you've come to advocate as a result of this research?
Well, we've got we know that the obesity epidemic is an interaction between this new food environment, which we really haven't well defined. There are certain substances and mixtures of macronutrients and chemicals that we think are having this hyperactive effect on our reward center. So there's the food environment, which we absolutely have to control, and which Kelly's Center for Food Policy is leading that national fight and raising awareness of how we have to regulate our food environment more, because ultimately we are like...
Including regulating food ads, for example.
Right. Yeah. We are like rats. You put us, surround us with this toxic food, and we do overeat as a population, some of us more than others. And we know that there are certain life experiences and exposure to stress that cause the reward center to look more like someone with true addiction.
This was your research, stress largely, wasn't it?
Right. So I think it's got to be both a combination of looking and regulating our food environment, as well as understanding on an individual level how to cope with and deal with our food environment to prevent, excessive early morbidity.
Rob Lustig, you wanted in here. Go ahead.
Can I make a comment here?
Yeah.
Every single substance of abuse has an individual component, that is rehab, along with a public health component, whether it be taxation or restriction or interdiction. Now, we tried this with ethanol, the interdiction idea. That was called prohibition. You see where it got us. But the bottom line is we have an entire American agency called the BATF specifically designed to handle all of these addictions for us, to limit our ability to consume things that are addicting, alcohol, tobacco.
Not food.
Well, not yet. But that's the question. If fructose and ethanol are synonymous in the brain, which is my thesis, and also in the liver, which is what's causing all the disease, then the question is, can we rely on individual efforts to try to reduce consumption? And the answer to me is no, based on all of the other studies that have been done. We have 1,500 years of alcohol control policy to draw on. And the bottom line is that individual therapy has not worked once in the entire history of the world. It has required a public health initiative in every single country. The Nordic countries have handled this best by, number one, nationalizing all the state liquor stores so that the cost of liquor in every one of the stores is exactly the same. And they subsidize the low-alcohol beers and tax the hell out of the high alcohol spirits in an attempt to try to control consumption in a rational fashion.
It's ironic, though, because when you talk about food, it gets real hackles up. I'm sure we'll hear from some of the libertarians out there on this score, but I want to go to Rana Kabatsnik, because you've done a lot with mindful eating and the zen of eating and all of this cognitive relationship that we have to food, and have had some real success, haven't you?
So the model is based on a 2,500-year-old research project and results that are based on the Four Noble Truths of Buddhism, the first being the nature of life itself has a suffering component to it. And the Buddha describes suffering as an insatiable appetite and an unquenchable thirst, and actually described hunger in metaphor terms as the supreme disease. No matter how much we eat, drink, buy, have, it will never be enough. And so basically there's an illusion going on that the more pleasure we have, the more that it can endure. But in fact, it cannot endure. And that's the suffering component. We take this personally and think it's our fault that, you know, we can't sustain the pleasure. But actually, according to the Buddha, this is actually built into the human condition.
These are what he called dukkhas. These are just
dukkha. Absolutely, yeah. Dukkha is the pursuit, the craving of trying to sustain pleasure, which is unsustainable, to trying to avoid pain, which is impossible. It's built into the human condition, and the delusion of not seeing that that there's a transiency to every experience, and no matter what we do, it's unsustainable. So the model of addiction that the Buddha proposed is that we have to look at the nature of desire, to look at the nature of craving, that it exists within ourselves, and that we cannot depend on the environment to control it, because that's the nature of life. It's unsatisfactory.
If we can't depend on the environment to control it, then why do we need laws when we can use our own emotional brain power?
Well, we can use our insights, the Buddha said. And unless we have insight, then the power of craving and illusion will dominate. So the purpose of mindfulness meditation is to look at the nature of suffering, is to dissect the dynamics of desire and apply the antidotes. And that's the medical model. There is a treatment plan, as I said, that's 100 years old, and that has been applied and has been successful. And mindfulness is known as the medicine that cures the disease of desire. It produces insight. And when insight is sustained, we do see the transient nature of life, that suffering is unavoidable. avoidable and impersonal, and that the cause of it is craving pleasure, trying to avoid pain, and the illusion that that these things can be sustained. And once you penetrate the psychology and the dynamics of desire, it completely changes your perspective.
Right, so I can think Buddhistically, and I can in that way avoid sugar. You're saying I can make myself lose the craving, see the delusion that's operating, think in this Buddhistic way, and then not have the craving for sugar.
No, the craving for sugar, you get from a Buddhist perspective, you see how the craving works. You see that it's often shameless, that it's very manipulative, and that there's a separation
between... No, but forgive me. Are you saying that the insight can lead me to conquer my need for sugar as opposed to being driven by a need for sugar that may be addictive?
Yes, you can conquer the need, but it still could exist, but you don't pay as much attention to it. You don't let it... through these insights and the power of these insights, you see that no matter how much sugar you consume, it's never going to satisfy the emptiness that is the essence of the human condition, that hunger is the supreme disease. But it can be cured, and there is a treatment plan to do that.
But there are also practical things about mindful eating, eating slowly, for example, and just concentrating on what you're eating and being mindful of what you're eating in the even non-Buddhist sense.
Absolutely. You can be mindful of what you're eating. But when I teach mindful eating, I talk about the mechanics of mindful eating and slowing down and being aware of the different components of it. But I also talk about the hindrances, what pulls you away, because that's in the Buddhist model. It's just as important to look at what pulls you away from mindful eating. It's usually the desire for pleasure, or it's impatience, or it's really not seeing or doubting that that pleasure can be sustained. And so there's this compulsion back, that addiction back, to try to justify that pleasure can be sustained. And that's the ultimate illusion, that we can avoid pleasure we can sustain pleasure and avoid pain and not see the facts of life that dominate and what the mechanics of desire are, these shameless mechanics of desire.
Let me go back to Professor Appel, because you wanted to say something here, but I want to get back to stress also as a factor, because that's where so much of your research is. But you wanted to say something here?
Well, actually, it is about stress, Rana. I really appreciate your perspective. I think mindfulness on an individual level can be very powerful if people can practice it. What we're fighting against is an epidemic of stress, societal stress. So under
High caloric food actually provides some comfort from that stress, doesn't it?
That's exactly right. So rats who get to eat lard and sugar actually have a calmer, it dampens down their stress response. So there's this this negative feedback loop that is absolutely reinforcing to our brain that keeps us seeking dense calories under stress. Now, when we look at times of recession and depression, sales of candy, chocolate, and alcohol skyrocket. And that statistic is not a coincidence. That's our primal, our brain that over time has been wired to seek dense calories in times of stress. So, Rana, your point about suffering...
It's not my point. It's the Buddha's point. And the Buddha talked about stress, suffering, and hunger as the nature of the human condition. So, by the way, I want to make it clear that when I'm talking about this model, it's not my model. It's the 2,500-year-old model. And stress is unavoidable. Suffering is unavoidable.
But I can hear somebody saying this is almost a religious model in a sense.
It's the nature of the human condition. That's what it is.
To the brain under stress, it does shift the balance from our thinking brain or prefrontal cortex to our emotional limbic brain, which is the stress center and the reward center. And so we're shifted away from being able to control our behavior and more push toward our basic instincts, which are in part the drive for caloric food.
I just want to get the stuff out of my liver that's not supposed to be there.
But Michael, I want
to. I don't need the Buddha to do that, do I?
No, but I want to make sure it's not a religious.
No, but you're saying been proven. I could say to you, for example, Jesus has ways that can cure us also from our human ills if we believe in what he says, and I wouldn't necessarily be as wrong as you would be necessarily saying the Buddha.
No, because it wasn't just the Buddha. He provided a model of addiction based on the truth of life that it is stressful and that it is unsatisfactory and there's an emptiness.
As Gautama Buddha saw things.
He has 2,500 years of people who have applied this model and who have become free of it. So it's not just the Buddha. That's why it's called the oldest research and results study. So we have people who have uprooted.
Okay, but we want to hear some practical ways to break away from this, if you'll forgive me for putting it as such. And Dr. Lustig?
Well, instead of talking about how to get out of it, let's talk about how we get into it, because ultimately how we get into it is how to prevent it. I'm going to refer everybody to the most important video of the current century, Supersize Me. On day 18 of Morgan Spurlock's journey through McDonaldland, he sits on his girlfriend's bed talking to the camera, and he basically, to paraphrase, says, "I woke up feeling sad, sick, and unhappy. Started eating. Now I feel great. I feel so good, it's crazy. Ain't that right, babe?" And she says, "Yeah, you're crazy, all right." He just described withdrawal. Here's a man who was a vegan, because his girlfriend was a vegan, basically thin as a rail, and within 18 days of consuming high sugar, high fat also, but mostly high sugar calories, he basically became addicted. Anyone can do this. Anyone can slip into this. And the question is, what has our environment done to foster this in so many people in such a short period of time, 30 years? And the answer is, just look at your local street corner between the vending machines, the fast food restaurants, and all of the other venues where you can eat now, for instance, gas stations. I mean, whoever heard of having dinner in a gas station?
But I'm sorry, where does free will come in this? I mean, let's not discount this. People have the prerogative not to go to the gas station or the fast food place and can exercise their will. And to some extent, to obviate that or to ignore that is to ignore the reality of choice.
Mr. Krasny, if I lace your breakfast cereal with morphine and tell you, don't eat it, can you?
If you lace my breakfast cereal with morphine, you're in violation of the law.
Well,
now we don't have laws against lacing it with sugar. Cocoa Puffs, as toxic and as horrible as you may believe that to be, or I may believe that to be.
The bottom line,
we need those laws, you're saying. Yes?
What I'm saying is that the food industry has found a legal addiction. And they're playing it for all it's worth. Our sugar consumption has gone up sixfold in the last 100 years and tripled in the last 30. If you look at fat consumption, it's exactly the same. If you look at protein consumption, it's exactly the same. The only thing that's gone up is our carbohydrate consumption, and it's almost exclusively sugar. And it's because that's what's being put in all of the foods.
What about all the other stuff they're putting in our foods? They're putting a lot of salt in our foods. They're putting a lot of carbs in our foods. Not as addictive, not as to be concerned about?
Well, salt is certainly an issue, and it certainly causes disease. But there's no
I wouldn't want it if I had high blood pressure. Certainly.
There's no reward for it. There's no addiction for it. It doesn't cause the same kind of phenomena. So if you put somebody on a high-salt diet for, say, a month, and then put them back on a low-salt diet, the taste will be different, but they won't have any of these phenomena that we're talking about, binging, craving, withdrawal.
Fatty foods, the same thing? Not
same
addictive
thing.
In the
so
way
far,
that you're talking
thing.
About?
Well,
yeah. I would argue we don't really know what's in our food supply that is addicted. It's the layering combinations of high fat, high salt, high sugar, and the chemical additives.
Let us bring our listeners into this. You are welcome to join us. It's toll-free, 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls, so feel free to join us now, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. 866-733-6786. You can also send an email to forum@kqed.org, or you can join us online, posting comments or questions online by visiting kqed.org/forum and clicking on the segment. When we return, we'll hear from you, our listeners. We're with three professors from UCSF, Rana Kabatsnik, Lisa Appel, and Rob Lustig. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. There's new research that shows that certain foods actually can cause an addictive-like state in the brain, and researchers say that food addiction is one of the rarely discussed culprits of the obesity epidemic, which we're all certainly well aware of. We're talking with experts from UCSF this hour who are studying obesity and food addiction and studying about how certain foods actually interact with the brain and what we can do to lessen our unhealthy food addictions. And we're going to go right to your calls here. Let me again remind you that in studio with us is Dr. Rana Kabatsnik, who is assistant clinical professor in the Department of Psychiatry at UCSF and author of The Zen of Eating. And Alyssa Pell, Dr. Alyssa Pell is professor in UCSF's Department of Psychiatry and director of COAST, UCSF's Center for Obesity Assessment, Study, and Treatment, and Dr. Rob Lustig, who's professor of pediatrics in the Division of Endocrinology and directs the Weight Assessment for Teen and Child Health, the WATCH program at UCSF Medical Center. And our callers begin with you, Alex. Good morning.
Oh, hi. Yeah, this is Alex from Palo Alto, and I'm a member of the celiac and gluten-free community. And we all know that there's a protein in wheat called gluten, which has more than 12 different opiates. And granted that they're mild, but I'm wondering why that's never discussed when we talk about food addiction.
Rob Lustig.
Well, I know a fair amount about celiac, and I know a fair amount about gluten, and I know a fair amount about the pathogenesis of the disease in terms of the GI symptoms that occur. But I have to say I hadn't heard anything up to this point about opiates in the gluten itself. This is a new concept for me. I'll have to look it up. I do not know about this.
Do we know anything that's addictive aside from sugar as far as food is concerned? Is there anything that's on the screen right now that suggests the likelihood even?
Well, sugar's the one that we've basically sort of nailed from at least an animal standpoint.
From the rodents, yeah.
From the rodents standpoint. There are others that have been bandied about. Certainly fat is been suggested, although it doesn't have the same phenomenon. And you can look at the people on the Atkins diet. They're not over-consuming fat. It's one of the reasons they can lose weight. Certainly, we're concerned about some of the diet sweeteners as perpetuating the reward system because of sweetness. And there's some new studies coming out of the NIH about GLP-1 or glucagon-like peptide 1 secretion that may be contributing at the midbrain level that could be part of this as well. So I'm not suggesting that diet sweeteners are a good answer to sugar. In fact, the opposite.
Marie-Louise, join us. Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning.
Hi.
I'm echoing, so pardon me. But anyway, I'm calling to ask how it's decided that a rat is having stress. Because, and then it's said that when it's overfed, it will be less stressed. Well, it seems to me that anybody who overeats actually becomes kind of lethargic. And if a rat has not overeaten, it could just be that that rat has more energy. So I'm just curious as how you can decide that a rat is stressed or just kind of content and overfilled.
Alyssa, Paul seems sure. Tailor-made question for you.
It's a good question. With people, we just ask them if they feel stressed. We have kind of standardized questionnaires, and if people feel stressed, they tend to have the physiological stress response too. With rats, we do these standardized lab protocols that stress them out, like restraining them, putting them in a little tube, and that causes their cortisol to go up. They're the main stress hormone that spikes when we feel psychologically stressed. When we know that cortisol stimulates the brain to seek food, and cortisol and insulin together shape our taste so that we seek high-fat, sweet food. So in these rat studies, they show that if you feed a chronically stressed rat lard, then when you put them in the little restraint box, they don't have this cortisol response like the other chronically stressed rats that got the boring low-fat lab chow. That's the work of Mary Dahlman at UCSF. So there are, you know, very specific models where we understand how stress is causing overeating and abdominal obesity in rats. And in people, we have a lot of converging evidence that the same thing is happening. People under chronic stress shift their taste preference, so they're eating empty, dense calories, nutrient empty but calorically dense calories. And they develop this abdominal fat pad, which is, of course, the precursor to most of the major diseases we know about.
Let me thank the caller, and let's move to some of the emails here before I go to more calls here. Here's Kim, who says, I understand sugar can be a problem, but it seems that the really bad stuff is a combination of sugar with fat, such as cakes, candies, etc. I eat a ton of fruit, but I'm slim. Isn't the problem really processed flour and fat-laden sugary foods rather than natural low-fat sugars?
Great question. If you look at what comes out of the ground, it either has fat or it has sugar, but it never has both. Fat and sugar together is a concoction of the food industry. Now, I know why, because it's awfully good. That's what comfort food is about. That's what dessert is about. But the bottom line is, God didn't make it that way. We made it that way. And the combination of the two together is not just enticing from a pleasure standpoint, but in fact from a biochemical standpoint, from a reward standpoint, from an addictive standpoint.
Well, here's another listener who says, your guest is medicalizing normal biology. For 100,000 years, our ancestors were hunters-gatherers, walking or running for many miles nearly every day of their lives. They had to work very hard to get the small amounts of sugar, salt, fat, and meat that we require. Now all of those substances are available cheaply and abundantly, but we have not evolved in this regard since we learned to evolve our environment instead of ourselves. So we still feel the powerful desire for those substances that we had to have when they were hard to acquire. That's why so many people are obese. Solving this problem is difficult, but understanding it's easy if you start with the evolutionary model.
I couldn't agree more. I think we should post that on your website, because that is just absolutely – he could not have said it any clearer, and I could not say it any better. That's exactly right.
Right.
Well, the bottom line is, what changed was our environment, and the only way we're going to get out of this is to change it back.
Oh,
and that's going to be really hard to do.
There's another important point there. We are overexposed to highly palatable food, and that changes the situation. So it's not just that we like, enjoy – this highly palatable food, but it downregulates our dopamine receptor so that we feel the need for it, so that we don't feel bad. We go into a mild states of withdrawal that we probably don't even notice when we are not eating palatable food.
I have a question for Professor Kabatsnik. Here's Mark in San Francisco who says, the only thing that's worked for me is utter strictness, not allowing myself to eat any processed foods, period, because when I start, I can't stop. Gradually, I got to the point where I value feeling good all day more highly than the very brief pleasure of snacks. As Jacques Lalanne famously said, if it tastes good, spit it out. There's discipline. I mean, to some extent, you've been talking about that with mindfulness, haven't you?
Yeah, certainly the role of renunciation and being able to understand the nature of craving and how we romance the objects of our desire, and we give power to what we think is going to satisfy not just pleasure, but the end of stress or the end.
Yeah, think about what women say about chocolate, for example.
But what I think the wisdom that's coming from Mark is that part of learning and studying the nature of desire is seeing the underbelly of it, that, you know, that if there is a seduction to eat something that is going to create a backlash, you know, there will always be some kind of betrayal. There'll be the additional 700 calories. So the brownie always has its costs. That's why the Buddha really recommended investigating and knowing the nature of craving and clinging and suffering, because
I thought you were going to say the Buddha said avoid brownies, but he didn't.
No, he didn't say avoid brownies, but he says renunciation in limited doses gives you a perspective. You can see your passions flare up and see that, in fact, they're impermanent, that eventually they will die down. And so that gives you, you know, it's like a hammer stroke on the feeling of an understanding that craving doesn't last, and neither does pleasure, and that there's always a downside.
And Professor Appel, you had something to add?
Well, the caller brings up an important point about restraint, and some people who have true food addiction even use complete abstinence from sugar. What do we know about restraint? It has a fascinating effect on the brain, on the reward system. It primes and stimulates the reward system. How do we create addicted animals? We give them intermittent access to Oreos, so they get them and then they're taken away. And we know that that causes binge eating. And adding stress to that causes even worse what looks like food addiction in the animals. In people, do we have an analog to this kind of restraint,
yes,
forbidden foods?
Yes, we do. Because
why Oreos and not hydrides, by the way? We used to have big battles over Oreos and hydrides.
Actually, one of the most interesting things, if you look at people who decide to eliminate Oreos at Lent, for example, they were addicted before Lent, but when there's a deeper meaning, they could actually restrain themselves from Oreos during that. And another example is Ramadan. You know, the practice of fasting from dawn to dusk. The same people could be compulsive eaters, smokers, shoppers, but because they have that spiritual sense that this is for a higher purpose, that they are actually able to not only avoid it, but feel satisfied from the restraint.
I'm sorry, so, I have to read this email because it just came over the transom. She says, this is Karen in Oakland, who says, well, yes, if you take the pure Buddhist approach, you can rise above your hunger and not eat at all for an extended period, at the end of which you will enter a condition called death, which certainly will cure the hunger.
What I'll argue is that these are fascinating extreme cases, but the majority of people are restrained. They have forbidden foods or they're trying not to eat as much, and that leads to obsessive thoughts about food and can backfire into binge eating. So brittle, excessive restraint is actually one of the culprits, we think, in triggering the brain to be more have more of an addictive response to
certain foods. Yes, and this is why the Buddha talked about moderation in the middle way, and that it can be very unskillful to practice brittle restraint, but it also, in moderation for less extreme desires, can give you a very good window into the mechanics.
Now here's another listener who says, I rarely crave sweets, but often have to exercise self-control to limit my intake of fatty and salty foods. These are what I crave far more often. I mean, craving can be...
The object of craving is endless. There's no end to what we can crave, and this is what the Buddha called samsara. You know, the objects of desire will you know, keep going as fast as anything. This is time immemorial. This is why we have to separate the craving and grasping of it from the object, because the object doesn't have the power. It is the internal experience, whether it's biological or psychological, that has the power.
Let me get to our callers, people waiting patiently here. Jennifer, you're next. Good morning.
Hi, good morning, Michael. Thank you so much for taking my call. This is a fantastic topic for me, as I am a food addict, and I appreciate all the contribution your show is offering this morning. I know I'm a food addict because of my weight has fluctuated as high as 100 pounds at what I weigh now, and I have come to understand that when I introduce flour or sugar into my system, it sets up uncontrollable cravings and then a mental obsession along with quantities. If I'm eating quantities and then I have been unable to stop. And it's been 3 years that I have been abstinent. If you'd have told me 3 years ago that I seize candy would not be a part of my daily stop, and I would have said, you're nuts. And that I never imagined that I could have a life without food being such a obsession, a significant part of my daily functioning. And today, I am living a life, above and beyond my wildest.
Well, you're giving testimony, actually, is what you're doing. But we get into some of the psychodynamics of eating here, and let me defer to you, Elisa Pell, on this.
Well, I want to thank you for sharing that. I think that this is an invisible and unacknowledged syndrome in society, and while most of our research has been on the kind of subclinical overdrive to eat and lack of control people feel, there are people like many people like yourself where this drive for food has shattered sense of self, relationships, ability to function. It has a tragic effect on people's lives. And we don't have any research on how to recover from food addiction because right now it's invisible.
But you know, I'm sorry, I use myself here as a little testimony too. I think I was addicted to sugar. I love sugar. I gave it up simply because I had diabetes. I mean, that works very well. Because you think, I heard Dr. Oz, Mehmet Oz, saying when you're diabetic and you're eating sugar, it's like taking glass into your system. And I think that metaphor really captured my imagination.
Well, the fact of the matter is, nothing, succeeds like, that kind of death knell. You know, if you see that in your future, you know, you can do that. I mean, people can wean themselves off narcotics cold turkey. It hurts. Now, it just so happens that the level of addiction we're talking about with, say, sugar is less than, say, with morphine. But the bottom line is it's the same phenomenon, maybe just a little bit ratcheted down, but it is the same phenomenon. Can you do
it? But you can kick it.
You have to need – we have to scare kids into this.
Well, not only scaring. I was addicted to tobacco. I got off tobacco. I mean, how did I quit? Just cold turkey. That's the only way to do it, I think.
We take care of – a whole bunch of different kids at UCSF.
And I miss smoking, too. Excuse me.
We take care of all different races, and I'm not going to be pejorative about specific races, so I won't mention which races. But one race consumes double the sugared sweetened beverage consumption over the other races. We give everybody the exact same information at the same time, in the same way, at the same table. And one of the things we say is you got to get rid of every sugared liquid in the house. We bring them back at 3 months. Every single race except for one has gotten rid of every...
If people listened to you the last time you were on, they know what race that was.
Well,
you didn't identify it the last time you were on the air.
So we say to these people, you know, why haven't you been able to do this? And the answer is because water doesn't taste good. Water doesn't taste good. What do you mean water doesn't taste good? It's water. The bottom line is, when we try to get them to do it and they start getting comorbidities, they start getting disease, they start getting diabetes, they're now programmed to do it just like you were because, you know, you got diagnosed. And they then tell us about the withdrawal because they finally did it.
There is a grief involved in letting go.
There
is a grief involved of letting go of what you think is going to give you pleasure. But I would disagree with Alyssa that there is a treatment plan to end addiction. And it's not just with monastics. It's been with lay people for all this time. And it's called the Noble Eightfold Path. And this is what the Buddha said is the treatment plan to end the disease of desire, to end the insatiable. The unquenchable thirst, which he said is like, you know, when we feed an addiction, it's like drinking salt water. You know, we go about it the exact wrong way. And it's a three-part treatment plan that talks about sila, which is a virtuous way of relating to food and eating as something that's sacred and even a form of medicine to live a good life, to serve others, and to realize the tranquility of not being consumed by desire. The second is the mindfulness approach of learning of the insight into the true nature of existence, which is always going to have stress in it. It's built in that no matter what and no matter what our desire is, you can't fix the wheel off center, the Buddha said. And finally, there's the wisdom that comes from behaving and taking the steps that allow for wisdom to arise, which is the elimination of craving and the grasping of it and the illusion that anything else, that there's something beyond craving, that there is the state of being, which is contentment, which in Buddhist language is considered the highest form of wisdom and which is not cultivated. We get more refined in what we're offering. I mean, if you go into Starbucks, it could take, you know, several minutes to order a cup of coffee. I remember, you know, 30 years ago, you just said, I want a cup of coffee. Now it's two shots of espresso. Low foam, high foam, mocha, this, that. So, you know, desires are always going to get more refined, but contentment is the highest form of wisdom.
Well, here are some more emails about... along this line of discourse, Val says, as a nutritionist, I advise food alcohol-addicted people to substitute vitamin B-rich foods and minerals to rid themselves of their sugar alcohol cravings. It works. They calm down and their bodies heal. Buddhism is all well and good. I'm one myself. But vitamin B, altogether with minerals, is a tried and true remedy. Another listener, Richard, writes, Buddhism aside, parents give their kids way too much sugar today. What do these people propose? A tax on bananas and strawberries? Very high sugar content. Should I be taxed on my consumption of a piece of French pastry? Example, financier, macaroon, pain de chocolat to subsidize eating instruction for fat kids? There are limits. Parents should put limits on their kids. Some practical wisdom here from our lay audience. Another listener, Rich, writes, I'm over 300 pounds. I used to be over 450. I know many overweight people. My experience is that many overweight people have untreated depression. I know that my untreated depression pushed me to eat more. I think poor mental health system in America has a lot to do with America's weight issues. And I think he's right. A lot of people do eat to feed the hungry heart, as I think Jeanine Roth's book was titled many years ago, because they're depressed.
I want to address that. Years ago, I lived in Memphis, Tennessee, and we saw what was going on in the lower socioeconomic status areas of Memphis. The supermarkets all pulled out. Basically, it was only fast food restaurants and gas stations where you could even get food. We went to the Board of Aldermen to discuss what was happening and the disease process that was going on in the city of Memphis, which was just disastrous and was eating up the entire healthcare budget. And one guy at the Board of Aldermen looked down his nose at us and said the following: you want to take away the single thing in these people's lives that give them pleasure? You know, we had no answer for that. And here I am 10 years later, and I still don't have an answer for that. If that's the only way they're getting pleasure, this is a pretty sad commentary on our society.
That's a small p. You know, that's a small p of pleasure, but there's a pleasure beyond pleasure, which is the end of desire.
Let me go to more of our callers. I'm sorry, Elise.
I just want to agree with that caller that depression absolutely can fuel obesity. Our whole obesity research center at UCSF is trying to understand, trying to apply what we know about stress and depression and low social class and how that affects the neurobiology of eating. We're trying to develop new treatments. And I did want to mention that we have several novel treatments we're testing for overweight men and women and particularly pregnant women that are going to be listed on the KQED website in case anyone's interested in joining one of our studies. The current financial climate is absolutely fueling stress-induced obesity. We're going to see numbers changing. We already see it in consumption rates of junk food and candy. So it's again, an invisible pathway, but depression and stress absolutely fuel hunger.
Now, here's a listener, Adam, who says, you know, it's true that there's a problem with obesity and eating habits, but the kind of approach taken by your guests is just not helpful. Have they never heard of enjoyment? People actually, this gets back to your point, Rob Lustig, people actually like food that tastes good, and it's one of the pleasures of life, from fine French pastries to Krispy Kreme donuts to an ice cream with your kid on a hot day. Sweet things are one of the pleasures of life. Your guest trying to medicalize and demonize all sugars as toxic food environment denies the healthy aspect of pleasure in this often hard world, and we won't be making sugar illegal anytime soon. And
I'm not suggesting it become illegal. I'm suggesting that we need to do something about the continued consumption and the surreptitious addition of extra sugars to our foods.
And the excess. You're talking about excess. Let me get a call.
The American Heart Association said so.
Jay from Bodega. Sorry, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Two quick things. I'm hearing an echo. But
ignore the echo.
Okay. If you've looked at infant food formula lately, the first ingredient is solidified corn syrup. And I can see that starting a life of addiction. And the second thing is I had very painful binge eating for years. And what I found very helpful is I did dream analysis for about 9 months and had a childhood memory of neglect. And the binge eating disappeared. I haven't had it. It's been almost 20 years.
Wow. Now there's some more testimony. Thank you for that call. By the way, Professor Appel, you mentioned that the study would be on our website. We're not going to be able to put it on our website. So can you give an email address a website, excuse me?
Sure. If you log on to – if you Google COAST and UCSF you will find out about our study on pregnancy, and we're really trying to prevent the transmission of obesity because we know that obesity and stress in the mom can affect the programming of the baby and the lifelong trajectory of health. Our other study is at the Osher Center for Integrative Medicine. So, if you Google UCSF and Osher, you'll find the phone number to call.
And you've been working on pregnancy and weight loss as well, haven't you?
Right. We're just starting to up a large NIH trial looking at novel treatments incorporating stress reduction for reducing excessive weight gain in pregnancy. It turns out that women who start pregnancy as overweight tend to gain an excessive amount of weight, and about half of them never lose it. So we're really concerned both about the mom's health as well as effects on the baby.
Here's a practical question from a listener named Margaret. I agree sucrose, fructose are highly addictive. Is there another sweetener that's recommended that doesn't have the addictive response?
Well, we don't know about diet sweeteners yet. Like I said, little bit of data that we have so far on diet sweeteners suggests that they may maintain the same reward phenomenon, and the epidemiologic data says that diet soda actually contributes to metabolic syndrome as well. It's likely that what's happening is that people who are drinking diet soda are getting their sugar somewhere else, like, for instance, the ice cream float with the Diet Coke instead of the regular. But we don't have that data yet. I will tell you that the food industry recognizes that there's a problem and that they are seriously thinking about ways of reformulating the American diet. I'm actually going to two meetings this year sponsored by the food industry to do just that.
Here's a listener who says, I'm with Krasny here. I'm not sure where that is, but he says, can we push these folks a bit further on the role of choice? I love Coca-Cola. I think it's just about the greatest thing on earth, yet I managed to limit myself to about one Coke a month. Choice.
Well, the question is, if you are dirt poor and all you have is what's in front of you, do you really have a choice?
Boy, we're going to get into a debate on free will here, and that's beyond the scope of this program. Let's get another caller on here quickly. Daniel, thanks for waiting. Hi, you're on.
Yeah, two comments. One is that I just want to make sure we're including flour and other refined carbohydrates, which metabolically are pretty much the same as sugar.
Not quite.
I watch all my, you know, presumably health nut friends avoid sugar and then put away the white bread and doing the same thing. The other thing I want to mention is that there's been some really remarkable results, and I can't remember the name of the woman who published them. She started working on Native American reservations and has expanded to other groups and was initially dealing with alcohol but started working with diabetics and obesity and was treating people with nutrients, vitamins and large amounts of missing amino acids and so forth in their diet, and having much more success than conventional withdrawal and recovery programs.
Well, we've certainly heard and read about a lot of multivitamin programs. There's no magic bullets here, though, I'm afraid. Buddhism is not a magic bullet, if you'll forgive me for saying so. Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
For more information, if people are interested in mindful eating and all aspects of it, I encourage people to look at the Center for Mindful Eating website, tcme.org, and it's an educational website that people can join, and there's lots of information, research, and teleconferences that are available that cover many of the topics that we've discussed today.
Any other websites to give out from any of the panelists here before we call it a day?
For if you're pregnant and overweight and want to help us develop our study, 476-6028, Marin Thompson at UCSF.
Thank you, Alyssa Pell. Thank you, Rana Kabatsnik. Thank you, Rob Lustig. Appreciate you
Thank you so much.
With us on Forum this morning. We are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. Want to remind you that you can always let us know what you think about what you hear by emailing us, forum@kqed.org. We welcome your suggestions and recommendations as well, or call our listener call-in line, 415-553-3300. Thanks to Senior Editor Dan Zoll, to our producers, Kevin Guillory, Judy Campbell, Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.